Mrs. Comer, reel 3.
There were also a whole lot of people, a tremendous proportion of the population we call the neutrals. That is to say, to begin with, in 42, 43, they did not take one side or the other. Later on, very much towards the end, of course, they appeared and saying they'd always been pro-Allies.
What about the collaborators? What type of people were there?
Very mixed. The same as with the resistance, you had from the top layers to the lowest layers among the collaborators. A lot of them were incited by the wish to hold power in their hands, whereas others were poor and needed the money. In those days, the black market by then was raging, and if you needed something, you had to have the money to buy it on the black market.
Was there any political motivation for collaborating?
Well, some of them, I should think, the top people, certainly would be motivated by politics. They were of the extreme right, perhaps, and that sort of thing, and therefore embraced the same view of life as the fascists and the Nazis.
Did you come across people of that kind?
There was one in the village, one poor youngster who certainly was a collaborator. That was no doubt about it, but absolutely brainwashed. He didn't mean any harm, really. He was brainwashed.
But was he collaborating for political reasons?
Yes, perhaps for political, thinking he would have a better life when he was older. He may have been, well, at one moment 17, 18, and by the end of the war he was probably 19, simply.
What was the political outlook of the people in the resistance?
Resistance, once again, was a mixture. We found there were some who were, of course, right-wing, some who were, of course, socialist in their background, you know, and there were a few communists. They had at that time a cause, that is to say, get the enemy out of their country, and then they would speak of D-Day, but not so much D-Day, the day of arrival of the Allies. They were thinking more of D-Day as the day, the big day, when probably the Soviets would be right across to France. The socialists were just thinking of getting the enemy out and making a better life for everyone, and the right wing were about a bit held by the church and what Marshal Pétain said. But then when they realized how mistaken he was, then they certainly didn't have that idea anymore.
How did it come about that a Spanish communist should have been an informer?
Well, when Franco came to power, you see, he was terribly anti-communist and sent them out of the country or put them in prison. So those who didn't want to go into prison slipped across the Pyrenees, installed themselves in France. There was one chappie who said he'd been through the military school, the officer's school at Toledo, for instance, but he was very extreme left. He was definitely the extreme. He had gathered around him there in the Pyrenees, he'd gathered people of the same idea. You even have the cellist, of course, what was his name?
Casals,
Pablo Casals, who went across the Pyrenees and started the festival in Prades, you see. He had the leftish ideas and things. They all just came over. The language of the Pyrenees and the foot of the Pyrenees is a dialect which has more Spanish, I think, in it than French, definitely.
But what was the attitude of the Spanish émigrés to the Germans, generally?
Oh, anti, because they were communists.
But so how was it that the Spanish communist had given information to the Germans?
Money.
What was the political outlook of the actual group you were working with? Any definite outlook?
Not at all. I must admit, the people who had, first of all, when I was on the run one day after what had happened at Saint-Antoine, I was on my bike and looking for somewhere to go, and then I was taken to a farm not in the Rhea, not far from Condon, and they were Italians. They'd been refugees from Mussolini, who'd come over. But they were absolute, and still are, all of them, communists. But behaved beautifully towards me, received me, oh, umpteen times. That's where I had the sixth cow, as a matter of fact. But they were very good. Another spot, too, where the man had been, the husband had been a radio operator in the French Air Force, also purely communist, but willing to receive me because I was part of the equipment to chasing the Germans out. Then others, the right-hand man for the boss was a socialist and still is a socialist, and we had many of those. We had some right-wing, but few.
Was political differences of opinion any kind of problem in the resistance? Did it prevent people from working together at all?
We didn't notice it, actually, but then the boss was very wise there. He tried not to mix them, to be sure of getting what he wanted. When he pigeonholed them, he tried to get it in that way. We were the catalysts, if I can say, the two of us being English. And I must admit that we had, in the January of 44, a courier was sent out to us, though Hilaire didn't want one. We had our courier service established. A girl was sent out with a saboteur. He was French. She was half English, half French. And then in the April, because I had too much radio traffic, an assistant radio operator came out.
How did that work, having two people?
It worked very well. We had our, more or less, our own circuit each. He stayed more in one part. I was still going around a bit more.
So you didn't meet very often?
No, we met once before he started work even, and I realised it was somebody who'd been at Tame Park at the same time as I'd been. I don't know what's happened to him since, because I only saw him once after the war. But anyhow, he worked very well indeed, and the places where he stayed, which were in the south-ish of the Rhea, and part of the Landes, I think he was more with the right-wing people, if I can put it that way. But he worked very well, and everything went smoothly with him.
What was the role of the couriers?
Well, they had to take messages, not in handwriting or anything of that sort, but by word of mouth to other people, so that Hilaire and myself didn't have to rush around the countryside so much. And we did have a good circuit there, going round. Even soon after she came out, the courier had to go right up to Paris and things like that. We had contacts, and we had to find out what was happening, and then she'd go. One Frenchman, Hilaire, gave him the sole conduct of two departments, and he was working that very well indeed. He did it, so therefore he, for his messages, his dropping zones and that, we relied on the courier work.
Would the couriers have to have any special qualities?
Well, not to be too noticeable, to be able to be resourceful if suddenly you found your train wasn't running anymore and that sort of thing. They had to do it by bicycle, on foot or by train. Cars were a bit too risky.
Why was that?
Lack of petrol, you see. So if you didn't have petrol, how on earth had you found some petrol?
How would they have got petrol?
Well, that means that they'd bought it on the black market, and therefore they must be in contact with resistance group who'd pinched the stocks of the enemy troops and things like that.
Was there much of a German presence in your area?
There were quite numerous, but a lot of them were not too good. They weren't the first-class soldiers. After Stalingrad, they used to send quite a few of the wounded to recuperate in the Pyrenees and all that. They didn't like sending them home and showing that so many had been wounded, so they came out. And otherwise, they were far too old or far too young. It was occupation work. It wasn't so terrible until you got to the D-Day period, and then they sent in the good ones. The SS came in again.
What were they like?
The SS are the elite of the army, with their tanks and everything. And it was Das Reich, which was stationed several times, first much earlier in the war, and then they were taken away from Toulouse, and then they came back at the foot of the Pyrenees towards Tarbes and all that sort of thing. They had installed factories for aviation equipment and such like in Tarbes, so they were protected. There were some others, and then when D-Day turned up, they were given the order to move up towards Normandy to help in the war there.
What about the Gestapo presence in the area?
The Gestapo presence was always there. You never knew man or woman willing to give information to the Gestapo. Sometimes it was a personal vendetta between two families and things like that, but of course repercussions could be much worse indeed. Other times it was just for money, which was serious.
Did you know where the Gestapo headquarters was?
Oh, you always soon found out where they were installed. I mean, the one that interested us the most was the one at Osh, where some of our people were taken, put into solitary confinement and questioned and things like that. That was a bad one. It was just by the Kommandantura in Osh. Then other towns, Bordeaux and others, of course, had them too. And then they had sub-offices and branch places.
Which was the nearest place to you?
Well, it all depended where I was. If I were down in the Pyrenees, it was Montrejou. If I was somewhere else, you see, I moved around so much. The thing I was personally more frightened of were the milices, who were French traitors, as we call them. That is to say, wore a navy blue uniform and were worse to us than the Gestapo. They were Frenchmen taken up by the La Valdea group and went round trying to arrest people and finding out things. They were really dedicated from a political point of view.
Were there many of those around in Saint-Antoine?
Saint-Antoine there wasn't. They were more in small towns, I must admit. They couldn't afford they hadn't got the numbers required to do all the villages, but they would radiate from a town to the villages if they thought something was on, if something had been brought to their notice as to what was happening somewhere.
How long did you work in Saint-Antoine?
Well, only a few days when I returned there, because it was soon after that this man gave everything away. We called him Rodolphe, a big chap. He gave it away in the September, you see, so it was very soon. And all the men of the committee were taken, and some of the wives also taken to Germany.
How is it that you weren't picked up when Rodolphe gave it away?
Well, it was very alarming. One day I'd met Hilaire soon after that, and I'd gone to meet him to give him the messages, instruction from London. And as we got near a very small village, we were cycling, we saw on the shutters of the house, which served both as the schoolroom, one side, and the town hall, if I can call it, but it was a very small village, on the other side. and that were two identity kit kind of drawings of ourselves. So we looked at them, looked at each other. One went north and the other went west or south.
Were they very accurate identity
kits? Not bad at all. The only thing they couldn't give was the very Pearson look of the grey eyes of Hilaire. For myself, they gave it with the dark hair, and features were quite good. Certainly, he'd made a point of knowing what I looked like.
So when you and Hilaire saw these drawings, you just immediately split up?
Yes, he didn't even say a word. We didn't know there might have been a microphone or something. We didn't say anything. We split up. I know I went back north, and he went something south, southwest. I don't know exactly sure, but a message got to me soon after. He sent a courier along, a local girl, as we employed them then, saying, remain quietly where you are for the moment, and I'll find out how the land lies. So I remained there perhaps for 4 or 5 days. The longest I stayed was 5, and that was the dentist period, so it must have been 4 days at most, and did work from there. I did carry out my messages.
And then what did you do?
Well, then I got the instructions to go somewhere else, so I got on my bicycle and went there.
Where was that?
That was going along really very much to the north of Condon again, but it was going east from where I was at the time.
And where were you staying?
In a local house where I'd stayed before. They were willing to have me again. It was a bungalow, really, but this bungalow had a factory at the back, because that was the man where the radio mechanic worked, you see. But the bungalow gave on to a sort of a river was down at the bottom, or the side of a hillock, if I can, because that part of the country was very much up and down like that, and it was clear. It was very good for the radio. So I stayed there two or three days at most again, and then started my tour once more, but not going back anywhere near the Gironde.
What happened to you next?
Next, what are we now about now at that period? But that's really the start of the work. That was September 43, so that was the start. Then I went working and travelling mainly by bicycle. So really, that was the ordinary work of finding out what the fields that the people could put at our disposal, and sending the latitude, longitude, and thing and messages to the messages which would come back by the BBC to say that an operation was taking place. That we had to agree between us through my telegram, shall I put it, to make it a different word. Therefore, we knew that such and such a sentence meant that that ground would be receiving some material that night. So the men, and this would be broadcast by the BBC at 6 o'clock GMT and once again at 9 o'clock GMT, so as to catch the people. Always GMT, because you never knew what the time was going to be locally. The peasants worked on GMT, which they called the solar hour. That is the sunshine. They went by the sunshine. Sometimes they said the old times, but usually it was a sunshine. Le solaire. But otherwise, very often, the Germans had kept to bring it an hour forward, that is to say, German time. So we had to be ready for trains and things like that on German time, and for the others on GMT.
Did you have any narrow escapes when you were doing the work?
Not at that period, I'm glad to say. Nothing very extravagant. That happened later, towards the May 44. Then I had one or two. But that's jumping very far forward, isn't it?
What happened next, after this period?
Well, things quietened down, unfortunately, very much indeed in December, because weather was bad. December, we only had one operation. Our part of the world was bad weather, or else London, or England rather, was fog-bound or snow or anything. It was one or the other, so we only had one operation, worst luck. But still, we were able to carry out one little demolition work, which was putting out the engine repair hangar or shed at the Bordeaux railway station, or by the Bordeaux railway station. Our men were able to carry that out successfully. They did it on the 31st of December, thinking that the guard, the German soldiers, would be celebrating New Year's Eve, and to help that, the boss gave the money so that a case of champagne should be sent to them. So our men, who were workers there, one was an inspector of the work, were able to slide in and knew exactly where to place the charges. And what they tried to do was to place them always on the same spot so that they couldn't take out a spare part from one engine to put it on the other.
But of course you wouldn't be personally involved in that.
No, my own thing was to know it was on, and secondly, when it was a success, to get the message back to London that it had been a success.
Did you give the details of what had happened?
No, just said what had happened.
What happened next after that sabotage?
Well, to go to January, the period was very, very hard period then, simply because the people were beginning to lose confidence. Enemy propaganda was very strong, even from further away than Germany. It was said, oh, the English will fight till the last Frenchman, and things like that, which was a saying in French. They were putting that over the air, and people were beginning to wonder, aren't you going to come over? Because the food situation was bad. They'd kept what stocks they could of a little white flour to make bread, a little perhaps jam or something like that. They kept all that for Christmas, so that by the January they were very short of food, and bad quality at that, and the spirits went down. February it became a bit better. I did send a message home, could you give us a sign that something is going to happen? We would be very glad to be able to tell our people that. And the BBC started sending out a terrific lot of messages the following month. There was one for each group, in the whole of our country anyhow, but anyhow in the whole of our circuit, with the instruction that if somebody heard that message on the air, they were to down tools and join whatever headquarters had been allocated to them. This put in a lot of courage. They thought, oh, well, something's going to happen soon. Unfortunately, it was a bit early, but it did encourage them. They redoubled their calculations of what charge should be put on demolition plastic, for instance, on a rail, or on a strong steel pylon, or whatever was needed for the arch of an old bridge or a new bridge, and things like that. They got down to work. They didn't carry out any experiment, because we had that very early on in 43, which was disastrous. So at that rate, we just worked on paper, but they got it down very well indeed. They knew how to do it. They made little samples and then reused the stuff immediately so that it didn't get hardened up, and they put it in their tins already. Then, from other points of view, we were asked for things, for instance, of disinformation. We were asked to find a landing strip which could be used for airborne soldiers. So the boss went out and tried, and finally decided there was a very good one in the Landes, which was near the Atlantic, very close to the Atlantic, and we started clearing the trees, because it's a tree-covered, conifer-covered part of the country. They started clearing that out, wider than a motorway, I must say, and there's still part of it like that now. They did that very well, indeed. And then we were told it wasn't happening. And after the war, I discovered that it was one of the disinformation things. Of course, it attracted the attention of the enemy air force, who were quartered at Mont-de-Marsan, because it was in the same department. But nothing happened. And because nothing happened, to finish it off, they gave it up. They weren't very interested either. So we were able to use our other grounds, operation grounds in the district, quite safely once more. It was very good down there, because immediately after landing they could be hidden in the among the trees and taken away.
Did the delay to D-Day have very much effect on the morale of the actual resistance workers?
No, because other instructions would come through. We received one to say, your sentence, your little message will be such and such, and therefore you can warn them to listen carefully then to their own personal messages. So all that went well. We had a sort of warning one.
Did the resistance undertake any... the resistance in your area undertake any assassinations of people?
No, they took prisoners. But we didn't give instructions for any assassination. I regret to say that after D-Day there were some vendettas against the collaborators. The women had their hair all shaved off and paraded through streets and like that, but it happened in all the countries, apparently. Other countries as well. That was to show for a while that they had been collaborating.
Who was taken prisoner?
Well, prisoners, people we knew had been collaborating, you see.
And what was the purpose of taking them prisoner?
They were going to be, how would I put it, examined and condemned. They were condemned to prison, most of them, legally. There were some shooting, I gather, but that was absolutely unofficial.
But the taking of prisoners of collaborators was happening under German, when the Germans were still in control, was it?
They were no longer in control. They were getting out, definitely. But they were taken and kept prisoner in places and houses and places which were away from the Germans.
Did you see any of these prisoners?
I didn't go and see any of them, no.
So do you know how they were treated?
No, but they were fed. I know that they were properly fed, and as they weren't in cells or things like that, and well, maybe there were too many in a room, that is a possibility, when they had paillasses on the floor. But so did we.
Which month are you referring to about the taking of these prisoners?
After D-Day.
Can we go back to February 44, and can you tell me what happened after that? And
March and April was a stepping up, a tremendous number of operations, material being dropped to us, weapons and everything. We did all we could then, hiding them until D-Day was required, but distributing them as well. It was quite a lot of work for them all. But still they were encouraged, because finding this was happening, they decided, well, it must be coming up, or else they wouldn't do it. The real, to say what a drop was like,